This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Assassination of Julius Caesar on the Ides of March, in remembrance of March 15, 44 years before Christ. Who was Julius Caesar? A dictator or a populist? And who really was Brutus, who murdered him on that day? A young hero or a participant in a deep-seated conspiracy? This intriguing lecture by the noted author, speaker, activist, and scholar Michael Parenti provides surprising new insights into history and parallels to today's fight over democracy that are both shocking and amusing. Parenti spoke about his Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Parenti grew up in a conservative Catholic working-class Italian community in New York City. After receiving his PhD in political science from Yale, he risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. He was a prolific author and engaging speaker. Among his 22 books are History as Mystery, The Politics of the Mass Media, The Sword and the Dollar, and Land of Idols. Now in 2025, Michael Parenti is still alive at the age of 91, but he has retired from writing and public speaking. Sadly, he has dementia and is in the care of his family on the East Coast. This talk by Michael Parenti has been in the TUC Radio archives since 2003. It was recorded that summer in San Francisco at Modern Times Books. The store was packed, windows open to the traffic on Mission Street, and the evening ended in a standing ovation. Michael Parenti began the talk by challenging Julius Caesar's reputation as a ruthless dictator and reported on the many reforms enacted by Caesar that made him unpopular with those whose privilege he confronted. In fact, Parenti showed that Julius Caesar was only the last in a line of reformers dating back for the better part of a century, who were murdered by the Roman oligarchy.
He was killed because he began to infringe on the prerogatives of the aristocracy. He was killed because he canceled rent payments for an entire year. Do you know how much a landlord likes you when you cancel rent payments for an entire year? That doesn't win popular. And most of these aristocrats were landlords. They were slumlords. Cicero was a slumlord. Crassus was the richest man in Rome. Most of his money, well, he had estates, he had merchant trade and all that stuff, but most of his money came from buying up many of the slums. They hated him because he instituted debt cancellation. Suetonius reckons about 25% of the outstanding debt in all of Rome was canceled by Julius Caesar. 25%, one-fourth, that's a lot. You know how creditors feel when you cancel debts on them? They don't like that either. He canceled it because the rates, interest rates were about 45% interest is what you paid on a loan. Another thing he supported was land redistribution. For centuries, Rome had been victualled by the farmers, independent, small, poor farmers working the rich lands of the Campania region around Rome. And the land was publicly owned. It was the agar publicus. It was public land. And the farmers paid a modest rent to the public treasury. And you had these aristocrats not making a penny on the whole thing. All that land was sooner or later expropriated. So there was the move among the reformers to redistribute some of that land. Caesar also did some other things. He argued that every rich landowner who had a slave labor force had to hire one-third of his force as free labor. This would create more jobs for the proletariat. That's what they would call the proletariat. And it would also cut in on the profits of the very rich and give some of it back to the people. Another thing he did was impose luxury taxes and limits on how much wealth can be accumulated. The limits were very generous. So that's why they hated Julius Caesar.
The assassination of Julius Caesar is a story, in Parenti's words, of large land holdings and death squads, masters and slaves, self-enriching capitalists and plundered provinces, profiteering slumlords and urban riots. Featuring corrupt politicians, money-driven elections, and the political assassination of popular leaders.
It's a very funny thing in history, because what you're dealing with here are intentions and motives. And no one's ever seen a motive. Motives are not empirically observable. We only can impute or ascribe a motive. We can never really see one. You see the actions, and then the people who did take the actions give you a profession of what their motive was, and you can accept that or not accept it. You know, I attacked Iraq because it had weapons of mass destruction. That's what motivated me, you see. But you can test it in certain ways. I mean, you can't test it as you could in a laboratory, where you say there's an independent variable, a dependent variable, and you hold this constant, you control for that, and oh, that didn't work, or let's run it through again, this time we'll do another variable. You can't do that in history, it's true. You can't say, hey, let's all do the French Revolution over just one more time, but this time, would you please? That doesn't happen. But you can weigh evidence against other evidence, you see. Consider this. The Roman senators, the assassins, killed Caesar because he was becoming a dictator, and they wanted to preserve the Republic. That's the central view. Okay, how could you test something like that? Here's how you could test it. Very simply, about 40 years before, Rome did get a dictatorship. Sulla came in. Sulla brought an army into Rome, something that was a sacred rule. No general should ever lead his troops into Rome. Sulla came in and he murdered thousands of people. He murdered 50 senators who he felt weren't conservative enough. He murdered 1,000 equestrians. He murdered thousands upon thousands of Democrats and common people. Sulla confiscated land. He wiped out the democratic power of the people's tribunes. He wiped out their power to veto certain senatorial acts. He froze out the popular assemblies. He bypassed them. He gave the Senate pretty much more power than it had in the Constitution three centuries earlier. So what does Cicero say about Sulla's bloody dictatorship in 63 BC, looking back on what happened in 80, which was only 17 years before, and Cicero lived through it? This is what he says about Sulla's bloody reign. Quote, all was basically admirable, though temper and moderation were somewhat lacking. So, a big hug and then a little small slap on the wrist. So the senatorial aristocrats say they didn't want one-man rule, but they did want one-man rule when it went their way, when it favored their class interests. Look, they even then supported, for the next hundreds and hundreds of years, emperors who came in. After Caesar and after the Second Civil War, it was Augustus who took over. They supported him. They never went back. They never advocated going back to a republican system. When push came to shove, their vast wealth meant more to them than state power. As long as state power was in the hands of someone who protected their vast wealth. That's the important thing to remember. Now, what's impressive is how many classicists of the modern era share the ancient ad hominem characterizations of Rome's reformist leaders. One of the things the ancients all say, and the modern guys accept it and repeat it and add adjectives of their own, the Gracchi were rash, erratic, power-hungry, demagogic, violating the constitution, unlawful. Clodius was ruthless, unstable, unprincipled. So was Catiline, so was Saturninus, and of course, so was Caesar. This investing, this ascribing ad hominem devaluing attributes to popular reform leaders is a technique that still goes on to this day. Salvador Allende, I remember, he was called erratic and volatile and this and that. Noriega was like worse than Hitler and so forth. Milosevic was worse than Hitler, crazed, driven by his wife and so forth. Hugo Chavez, mercurial, erratic, dictatorial. I've yet to read a New York Times article about Chavez where they don't use the word mercurial, the mercurial leader, you know, volatile. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, the same thing. You know, not a word with Hugo Chavez, not a word about the clinics he set up for poor people in Venezuela. Poor people who for the first time in their lives are able to get medical attention. Not a word about that. Not a word about the tuition-free schools he set up for the people of Venezuela, for poor people who could never send their children to school because they couldn't afford the tuition before. Nothing about that. These ad hominem characterizations extend not only to the leaders, but to the people themselves. Throughout history, gentlemen historians have been writing about the mob, the rabble, the people who are irrational, the people who do all sorts of things. The denigration of the common people as a shiftless, ignorant mob, dangerously irrational. Gustave Le Bon wrote a book called The Crowd. He wrote it about 130 years ago, in the late, relatively peaceful time of the late 19th century. And yet he sounds almost like a French aristocrat about to get whacked on the guillotine. And he's talking about the raging, irrational mob. The book is called The Crowd. It's been kept in print for 130 years. For 130 years it's been used and given to students, certainly in the US. And the ancient Roman writers were no different, nor the latter-day classicists. This is what Cicero says about the Roman mob, the rabble. That's what he calls them. Beggars, convicts, madmen, urban scum, slaves, foreigners, exiles, a starving, contemptible rabble. He admits they're starving, you see. But he doesn't see that as symptomatic of their victimization. He sees that as a deficiency that's personal to them. You see, the starving, unwashed. What do you say when people are unwashed? They're dirty. Why do you think people are dirty? Because they can't afford to go to the baths, the Roman baths. They don't have any running water. They don't have any olive oil to clean themselves with. They don't have anything. So that's why they're dirty. But no, you blame the symptoms of oppression on the oppressed themselves. Well, who were these people? If you read these historians, you find they were layabouts, wastrels, you know, just irrational thrill seekers at the bread and just waiting to live off free bread and free circuses. Had nothing else to do. First of all, you couldn't live off the bread dole. The bread dole for the Roman proletariat made the difference between starvation and survival. But it wasn't enough. You can't just live on bread. You need money for fuel. You need money for rent. You need money for clothing. They worked. That's what the Roman proletariat did. I'll tell you who they really were. They were masons, carpenters, shopkeepers, scribes, glaziers, butchers, blacksmiths, coppersmiths. I gleaned all these professions from the various descriptions of everyday Rome. Bakers, dyers, rope makers, weavers, fullers, tanners, metal workers, scrap dealers, teamsters, dockers, porters, and various day jobbers. They were the toiling proletariat of Rome. And what did they do? What did they do in their time on the stage of history. This is what they did. They fought for two centuries against kingships and overthrew a kingship. They fought and mobilized and organized secessions, refusing to go in the army, refusing to participate and work, and going off the Great Aventine Secession and such to win the right to popular assemblies. They fought for secret ballot and got it. They made common cause with slaves, sometimes, not always. They supported land reform, debt cancellation, rent reduction. They supported popular leaders like the ones I've been talking about, the Gracchi and Caesar. And they bitterly fought and opposed Sulla. As I said, I found that ancient history is not so ancient. I'll read you my favorite quote by Schumpeter. Joseph Schumpeter was a conservative economist. He wrote this in 1919 about Rome. He talked about Rome's imperial policy. And I haven't said anything about Rome's imperial. Caesar was also an imperialist. There was other things about him. I do write about it in the book that are not so admirable. His conquest of Gaul, his plunder, and all that. Definitely. And this is what Schumpeter said. The Republic was also an empire, just as our Republic is also an empire. He said, Rome, that policy of Rome which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. The fighting was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. So there you have it. That expansionism is not really a pursuit of power for power's sake merely. It's not just we want to have power and we want to rule. It's because they wanted to do certain things with that power. It's because they gained certain things. War and expansion was very favorable to the aristocratic class. They fleeced their own people. They fleeced the peasantry of the Italian peninsula. And they fleeced and they robbed from the entire empire. The Roman Empire was for them a very, very profitable thing. It was part of their self-enrichment, and that is something we should not forget. I was wondering if I could read something. I read a little piece of The Assassination. Would you like to hear that? This book has lots of sex and violence in it, by the way. I want you to know that. Let's see. On the penultimate day of his life, during the course of conversation while dining with Lepidus. Lepidus was Caesar's captain of the cavalry and a few other intimates. Caesar posed an unsettling question. What is the best sort of death? After his companions ventured various opinions, he himself commented that a sudden, unexpected end was the one he would prefer. That night, the story goes, his wife, Calpurnia, dreamed of seeing him lying in her lap with many wounds and streaming with blood. The next morning, much distraught, she implored Caesar not to stir from the house and to postpone the Senate session. His wife's remonstrance gave him pause, since she ordinarily was a composed and level-headed individual. Not given to womanish superstitions, as Plutarch put it. That's in quote, womanish superstitions. Plutarch himself was richly freighted with superstitions, presumably male-gendered. He tells us that just before Caesar's death, fire issued from the hand of a soldier's servant, yet left him unburned, and he names a few other things. An animal sacrificed by Caesar was found to contain no heart, quote, a very bad omen because no creature can subsist without a heart, the great historian reminds us. Omens aside, the political climate was disquieting enough. as Caesar himself had misgivings, and I go in here and I talk about that, and then I quote from Cicero's reassuring speech in the Senate and says, "Caesar, how could you suspect that there are enemies here? We all love you. The way you have treated us so magnanimously, you won the Civil War and yet you gave us back all our land, and you've been such a wonderful guy. We swear we will protect you ourselves with our own breasts and bodies." I mean, these cloying reassurances did not leave him completely reassured. Now on the fateful morning of 15 March, 15 March is the Ides of March. The Ides in the Roman calendar are the 15th, 13th, 14th of every month. It varies, one of those days. There was the Calends, that's the first of the month, and the Nones are usually the 9th or 7th of the month. They just had the naming of something, and they would calculate things backwards from, they say, the third day from the Ides, which would mean March 12th. And the second day would be March 13, and so forth. It was a very cumbersome way of calculating the calendar. I gave that a page. That was about all it was worth, but it was kind of interesting. Now, on the fateful morning of 15 March, uneasy about Calpurnia's dream, Caesar turned to Antony, who had just arrived, and instructed him to go postpone the Senate session. But Decimus Brutus, one of the few to have regular access to Caesar's residence, entered as Antony was about to leave. On hearing of Caesar's decision, Decimus strongly urged the reconsideration. The senators had been waiting in attendance for some time. Decimus Brutus, by the way, not to be confused with Marcus Brutus, one of the key conspirators, Decimus was rather close to Caesar. He had been his general in Gaul, too. But when the final time came, choosing between his personal loyalty to Caesar or his class interests, he joined the aristocratic conspirators. Anyway, Decimus convinces him that the Senate, I'm going to paraphrase some stuff, they're going to be rather miffed if he doesn't show up. He called the session, and is it like Caesar to hide behind a woman's fears, or does he give in to superstitions like this, and why doesn't he at least come and tell them he's got to postpone and maybe, you know, we can have this some other time? And then there's also stories that a Greek teacher of logic, who had been a former tutor of Marcus Brutus and caught wind of the conspiracy, had attempted to tip off Caesar. One version says he went to his house, but he had just missed him. Another was he got to him and gave him a warning paper, but Caesar never was able to read it because of the press of all the people around him and such. But anyway, Caesar makes his way into the hall. The conspirators stationed a backup complement of gladiators in the adjoining theater, which is an arena, really, who could rush to their assistance should senators loyal to Caesar give them trouble. They were especially concerned about Mark Antony, a physically powerful man not easily routed. He would likely be situated close to Caesar. So they contrived to have Gaius Trebonius, Antony's acquaintance and one of the conspirators, detain him in conversation outside the hall. Upon Caesar's entrance, everyone rose to their feet. A group of senators quickly gathered about him in an apparently friendly manner. Caesar had scarcely occupied the ceremonial chair when one of them, Tilius Cimber, petitioned that his brother be allowed to return from exile. Caesar waved him aside. This was not the time for such a matter. They could pursue it on some other occasion. Others moved close, pretending to join in the request. Then suddenly Tilius laid hold of Caesar's robe, yanking it down from his shoulder, the signal for the assault. The first blow came from behind, delivered by a trembling Publius Casca. It missed its mark, grazing Caesar about the shoulder. He whirled about, seizing his assailant by the arm, wounding him with a stylus he used for writing. Caesar then bolted forward, only to be slashed in the face by Cassius. Desperately flaying at his attackers and issuing furious cries like a trapped beast, he took another blade into his side, then swift thrusts into his thigh, his back, and his groin, until he staggered and collapsed, some say, at the base of Pompey's statue. Even then, the assailants continued savaging him with their daggers, some of them accidentally cutting each other in the melee. Suddenly all was quiet. Caesar lay motionless, bleeding to death from 23 stab wounds. At this point, Marcus Brutus turned to the Senate assembly to reassure them that all was well. He would now set forth the reasons behind this act of tyrannicide. Certainly, here was an apt venue for discoursing on the more unsavory imperatives of Republican restoration. But the senators were in no mood for a civics lesson. Frozen in astonishment for the brief seconds of the onslaught, they began stampeding out of the hall, tripping over each other as they fled, some fearing they might be the next victims, others just wishing to distance themselves from the murder and all its frightful implications. Brutus and his confederates followed them out, triumphantly brandishing their blood-stained weapons. Being still hot from their exploit, they marched as a body, not like perpetrators who thought of taking flight, but with an air of lordly assurance, calling to the people to reclaim their liberty and inviting persons of rank to join them. They didn't invite people to join them, they'd invite persons of rank. Some of the latter did enter their procession, acting now as if they too were authors of the bloody design and could claim a portion of its honor. In the empty meeting hall, Caesar's body lay crumpled in lonely silence throughout much of the day. Eventually, three of his slaves ventured in and carted it away. Thus did Gaius Julius Caesar meet his sorry fate in his 56th year on the Ides of March, 44 BC. 40 years earlier, on that very day, a graceful, handsome 16-year-old youth strode amidst a joyous gathering of family and friends who prayed that the divinity might fashion a brilliant destiny for him. It was a festival celebrating the threshold of spring on the Italian peninsula, when living things are touched by the sweet stirrings of nature reborn, and people lift their hearts in the hope of better times to come. And so we too should hope for better times to come, and not only just hope, but we should struggle and fight for those better times. Thank you for your kind attention.
That was the acclaimed author, public speaker, and social critic, Michael Parenti. Parenti spoke about his Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. This rebroadcast is part of the very popular and ever-expanding series on what Parenti calls real history. That's a different and intriguing reading of a surprisingly large number of all too familiar stories, such as The Myth of the Founding Fathers, The Real Causes of War, From the Spanish-American War to World War II, and The JFK Assassination. Parenti grew up in a conservative, Catholic, working-class Italian community in New York City. After receiving his PhD in political science from Yale, he risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. Among his 22 books are Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, History as Mystery, God and His Demons, and The Face of Imperialism. This talk was recorded at Modern Times Bookstore in San Francisco in the summer of 2003. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.